Commander Repard, Real 11. We were looking at your time in the Mediterranean aboard HMS Tartar on advanced posting at Bone or Bomb, and then at other times you were detached for duty on the battleship Screen. I wondered if you'd like to comment on those periods.
The time I'm talking about is when there were still Germans in North Africa, and we were trying, using Bone as an advanced base from the Western Med, to prevent the provision of supplies across the Narrows from Sicily or to any other base into North Africa. When we were at Bone, we tended to be at sea every night doing this thing, because it wasn't all that far from the Narrows. But every now and then we went back to Algiers to boiler clean or for a rest or whatever it was. But it always seemed to us that if we were in running order and we hadn't already been grabbed to go back to Bern, we tended to find ourselves on the screen of the main fleet in the Western Med. Presumably that fleet was at sea there frequently because they were still worried about the French. I'm not sure why they were at sea, but the moment you went anywhere near them, you found yourself swept onto their screen. And that meant very different work for the officer of the watch, and indeed for the captain, because if you were more than 200 yards away from your station, you got a rude signal from the admiral to say so. And it was all designed to keep a submarine-free front between all the destroyers. But as we were zigzagging the whole time, to a pattern where you had to look up in the zigzag book which zigzag you were doing and therefore what the zero time was and how many minutes you turned, how many degrees, in which direction. And you did it without further signal, purely because of the clock. It tended to be rather exciting if you lost count of where you were, what the time was. And we found that rather boring compared to the business of going to sea and getting on with the war, fighting things and being shot at and shooting at people. However, whenever you were in harbour with the fleet, there were invariably patrols and exercises and all the other things, sentry duties in effect. And
what type of patrols and exercises? Would you still remember?
Exercises were pretending that you'd found a spy in the place and you had to search everything. Running boat patrols at night to stop somebody coming and dropping a mine alongside you. The worry, of course, was that one would get inefficient on some aspect of being a member of a fleet. And that meant that the staff officers concerned were invariably sending out sheaves of orders telling you what to do and how to do this, that, and the other, and then trying to exercise you in actually doing it. And we found it much more peaceful to be away from the fleet under those conditions, where we were just getting on with the war rather than fighting a paper war as well. No doubt all this bump would have increased our efficiency to fever pitch if we'd only had time to read it and get on with it. However, the turning point of everything we did and said was actually our going reputation as a ship, Tartar as a ship, that is, because we had been fighting at the front end of some very exciting events for quite a long time by then. And I suppose we became rather self-important about it. I don't know what it was. Certainly at one stage when we were at Gibraltar, we received orders unexpectedly to proceed to sea with the utmost dispatch. I suppose there was a panic of some sort. I can't remember what it was. But I do remember the captain was ashore having a party with his friends from other ships. And when he came back, we found him and got him back just before we were going to sea. He was immaculately dressed as an Edwardian cricketer at a house party with a stripy blazer and beautiful white shirt and a cricket cap on top of it all. And he had been enjoying his party so much that when we went out of harbour astern, he stood at the compass giving all the orders as though we were going ahead, and the navigator had told the quartermaster to ignore anything the captain said and took us out astern from the magnetic compass, which had its own voice pipe just above the main gyro compass. But we thought that was marvelous. We admired our captain enormously and thought he was just the chap, and we would have protected him from any criticism at all. a lovely man, in fact.
Now, the next thing is you seem to have, while you were at Gibraltar, which is where you were based at, when you were with the fleet, you went on a patrol, an anti-submarine patrol, the Hudson. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I'd met a wing commander or squadron leader ashore in Gib and told him that I'd been interested in flying. And one way and another, I was invited to go flying with him the next day. And as we were at longer notice for steam, and we couldn't have got underway during that time, captain approved that I should go for a flight and liaise with the RAF in that way. So I duly went along to the airfield at Gib, got myself rigged up with Mae Wests and parachute harness and all the other things, and found rather to my surprise that I was sitting in the second pilot seat of this Hudson. We were going on a patrol up the Mediterranean in the direction of Merseyrail. And this was actually, I think now, before we had actually taken North Africa. Anyway, whatever the reason, we were flying merrily along just below the clouds, somewhere short of Merseyrail, when the captain decided he had to go down and spring a leak, as the plane was flying itself on automatic pilot. I was sitting there admiring the view, and to my considerable surprise, I saw Junkers 88. And equally clearly, we had to do something about it fairly quickly. So, not really knowing what I was doing, I took the automatic pilot out and made for the nearest cloud, probably, in retrospect, doing things which must have frightened the rest of the air crew on board the Hudson almost as much as I was frightened of the German. Anyway, it stopped the captain getting back up to the controls because I was throwing the plane about a bit. And I did get into a cloud before the Junkers 88 got close enough. And the captain came back and took over, and it was only after we'd settled down after that event, and presumably everybody's hearts had stopped beating as fast as mine was, that he said, well, the reason that he was flying the patrol at all and hadn't got a second pilot was that yesterday's flight on this particular patrol had been shot down. But they hadn't bothered to tell me that bit. That was that story. But as we came back from that flight, we had noticed some ships way down below from about 5,000 feet, I suppose, 6,000 feet up. And this was a local part of the fleet who opened fire on us. Well, I very often opened fire on aircraft which I couldn't identify because shoot first and ask questions afterwards when I was in a ship. But I found it a very rude thing to do indeed when I was in the aeroplane. Couldn't they see we were a Hudson, etc.?
Now, while you were there, you mentioned in your letter, which we're using as a bit of a backdrop to this period that has been deposited with the Department of Documents and in your file as well, you mentioned meeting Ray McCaig, and I know you've got some other friends at the time. Would you like to tell us about these particular pals of yours at the time?
Well, the two who were my greatest friends when we'd both joined as cadets in 1939 were Ray McCaig and John Lake. John's father had been an admiral, but I think he was fully retired by then and was running a brewery in Cambridge. John also had a sister whom I fell violently in love with at one stage. Ray was a seaman to his fingertips. He'd been at Loretto. I think John had been at Stowe. And between us, we used to go boating at Dartmouth and sailing and all the rest of it and made some mistakes the hard way, of course, when we were training. But I was always delighted when I came across them at sea. And in the Mediterranean, Ray McCaig turned up during this period when we'd invaded North Africa. And his ship was with the fleet. And we were usually in the advanced force somewhere up in the Narrows. But it was great fun to meet Ray. He was the first lieutenant of Puckeridge by then. And Puckeridge was the Hunt class destroyer. And the captain of Puckeridge had become unwell, and so the first lieutenant had been promoted to captain. The first lieutenant was a man called Ian Jemison, who later featured in my life as in the naval girl playing hockey for the Navy, and he also played hockey for Scotland, I think. And Ray became first lieutenant. In that role, he arranged that the Carley rafts could be slipped from the bridge rather than having to go down to the places where the Carley rafts were on each side of the ship. If the ship was sinking quickly, one of the problems was to get these rafts into the water so they would float off, because they were normally secured so they couldn't be washed off or fall off at sea. And Ray introduced sort of remote control for slipping all of them from the bridge. And when Puckeridge was torpedoed, she had been attacking the submarine that torpedoed her, and the depth charges had been set just before they were going to be dropped. And she was going down by the stern. And Ray managed to slip the Carley rafts so that the majority of the ship's company, who were not killed in the torpedo attack, were able to get into the Carley rafts before the depth charges exploded as the ship went down. So he saved a great deal of life there. But he was a brilliant man, and he, before he finished his naval career, he became an admiral and was our representative in NATO in Brussels. But John Lake was also in the area in a cruiser at the time, and I met John when we
also a lieutenant.
Yes, we were all the same age. I met John in Augusta, just after the invasion of Sicily, where his cruiser was. I was in Tartar, and I realized he was there, and I went over to have dinner with him. And dinner went on, rather, say the least of it, and we were telling each other stories, because he knew that I was very fond of his sister. And I'd been up to Cambridge and met his father, and indeed his mother, when we were doing subs courses. And so it wasn't until about 4 a.m. that we realized that the night was passing away and that I should have been back in my ship, probably. But rather than have a ship's have one of the ship's boats called away, we decided in our slightly bemused state that we would actually take one of the cruiser's boats, because after all, we were able to drive a boat, weren't we? And that meant manning the boat rather privately by climbing out along the lower boom and trying not to fall into the water off the lower boom, which was about 15 feet up. And having made our way down there, one of the lizards hanging underneath the boom, this lovely boat was secured to, fast motorboat. So we finally got into this just before daylight and set off across Augusta Harbour to take me back to the ship. Well, one way and another, we didn't actually get to my ship until both watches of the hands had fallen in. So I was arriving back in the appropriate dress to have dinner out. And as I came up over the onto the quarterdeck of my own ship, and John took his motorboat back to face the music in his cruiser, I was greeted by the first lieutenant, who paid no comment at all the fact I just arrived back late, or that I was dressed in the wrong rig. He said, "I've just told your division to do this. Go and see it happens." So nobody paid the slightest attention. We'd been relaxing. John left the Navy and became worked for IBM for quite a long while. Both he and Ray McCaig are now sadly dead. The lady with whom I fell in love unfortunately married somebody else who became a Member of Parliament, whom she'd met leaning over the rail as the ship sailed from Liverpool. She was a physiotherapist. And one of the things I'd loved about her was the way she rubbed my legs when I'd hurt myself playing hockey during the sub courses. But when she went off, she left me a silver pencil and a loving letter, which I duly had. The next letter I had was dropped from a Lancaster into the sea with our mail in the next ship. I will be talking about Byron. And the letter said, "From Algiers, you'll be surprised to hear I'm married," which I was, very surprised indeed. I found it alarming. And they'd met leaning over the rail on the way out, and he was about to be dropped into Yugoslavia to help Tito. So they'd got on with it and got married. I found that very disturbing indeed for a long time. So much so that when I was reading the letter, the engineer officer of that ship suddenly turned to me in the wardroom and said, "Are you all right, number one?"
Now, the other thing, what about when you were ashore, but either at Algiers or at Bone or whatever?
Well, going ashore was a rare event because you had to have the ship really boiler cleaning before you could have any reasonable time away from it without risking missing it. But at one point I was sent on duty ashore to the French Jeunesse, they were called. These were the young French people who had been part of the resistance group, and they were well south of the coast. And I was sent down to call on them and tell them they were marvelous. And they were in the forests south of Algiers somewhere, and they were speaking almost entirely French, which I was not too good at. I could do a little bit of French. But it was apparent that I had to praise everybody within sight, so I did that immoderately. And they explained to me what they'd been doing and how they'd been able to run messages because they had the most marvelous stallion that anybody had ever seen. And it was a great privilege. I was offered a ride on the stallion. Well, I always thought that horses kicked at one end and bit at the other, and I was not a good horseman by any means. However, quite clearly, honor and all the rest of it required me to ride this damn thing. So in the forest, where their huts were, I duly climbed aboard, and the thing set off. Almost the moment I settled in the saddle, it went off lickety-split down the forest tracks. And I couldn't stop it, and I couldn't turn it. Eventually we came out of the forest, and we were on the side of a slope where there were a few trees growing, and it decided it was going to rub me off on the trees. So I was doing Cossack stuff, one leg lift up over the top and just standing in one stirrup, and then changing around and trying to rub off the other side. So eventually I got frightened of that and dismounted, holding on to the reins. And when my heartbeats had come back to normal again, I decided it was time to climb aboard and found it incredibly difficult. So I'd get one foot in the stirrup when that part of the horse would disappear, and I was hopping along behind it with one foot in the stirrup, one foot hopping. And it took a long time to get back aboard, but once more, as I settled into the saddle, it set off lickety-split. I didn't even know the way back by then. I was lost. And I'd been away about 20 minutes or 25 minutes. But we were clearly back on the forest track, and I began to recognize that we were going in the right direction. Then I found the French coming down the forest track towards me to find out whether I'd fallen off, whether I was all right. So I was just trying to say, you know, "Allo," and the things one says. But unfortunately, the horse wouldn't stop, and I went not only straight past the Frenchman, but straight through their village and out the other side as well. And it took a little while for me to turn round and a lot of Frenchmen to grab the front end of the horse and for me to get off it. Whereupon I was in trouble for over-exercising their horse. They didn't sympathize with my view that the horse had been over-exercising me. But it all went very well, and we sang the Marseillaise or something, and so honor was satisfied, and they'd been told they were good. That was the only official trip I had ashore, I think.
What about...
In Bone, however, I did go sailing one day in the small Royal Naval Sailing Association dinghy we had on board. By myself, I think. And I saw the most lovely flowers growing very close to the sea in the entrance to the harbour. And it was a plant about 4 feet high, absolutely covered in floriferousness. And on a single stalk. I'm no horticulturalist, so I'm not sure what it was. Chincherinchi, perhaps? And if not, it was a large thing with bell-like flowers hanging down all round. So I got out my pusser's dirk and cut it off and put it in the boat and sailed off again. And as I sailed off, an infuriated Frenchman appeared. Apparently I'd pinched his favourite flower from the bottom of his garden. I didn't even know there was a house there. So I went back to the ship and said I wouldn't be going ashore again, and it was probably a good idea not to touch on to that bit of the headland. So we did have flowers in the wardroom for a little bit as a result. But my other runs ashore had been perhaps at Gibraltar before the landings, when the place was crowded with soldiers and sailors and airmen. And there I had, first of all, I'd been up to have a look at the apes, of course, as one does, and I'd even been into the underground places there where the command center was and had a look around for that. But I also met a beautiful wren. It was a time when a ship had been sunk on the way out with 20 or 30 wrens in it, all of whom had lost their lives. And so there weren't as many wrens, perhaps, at Gibraltar as there might have been, but there would never have been enough for the thousands and thousands of servicemen that were there. And I eventually said to this wren that I was going to be there for 2 or 3 days, and would she like to come and have dinner with me? And she fished out a diary and said her first vacancy was in 6 weeks' time. So I realized I was batting out of my league. But I did find the both the old rackets court at Gibraltar, and I found the sports shop at Gibraltar. The rackets court had been turned into a store for the Royal Army Service Corps, but the sports shop was still operating for some reason. And the man running the sports shop, whose name was Hoare, was related to one of the professionals in one of the public schools at home, and he knew about that I existed, which interested me. So I felt that there was a link with home, which I wouldn't otherwise have put down at all. I think it was about that time that the Polish Prime Minister, or Polish senior army officer, died in a crash on the Gibraltar airfield.
Sikorsky. Were you there at the time?
Yes, I didn't see it happen. Saw the smoke, well, went over the end into the sea.
Now, what about drinking? What were your drinking habits like, both at Gibraltar and in the North African ports?
My personal drinking habits had been limited always by the fact I didn't really like gin, which was the cheapest drink available on board. I enjoyed a glass of wine or two, but I was never a chap who drank very much, personally. The wine which was available in North Africa had the most extraordinary effect on the sailors, anyway, so that we all referred to it as Red Infuriator, and it tasted rather acid and cost virtually nothing. There seemed to be no good wines available, or maybe I just couldn't afford them. But I very rarely ate ashore. But on one occasion, I went ashore with the wardroom, and we went to, I think it was a brothel, called the Sphinx, or Le Sphinx, to be more precise. And the reputation for this was pretty sharp, say the least of it, because there had been people found having had a nasty operation, dead in the harbour, where they'd been near these places. So I took a revolver with me, and I went with the first tenant, who was also the navigator, whom we called Vasco for that reason, and the chap who has been a commercial traveller, Andrew Aikman, who was married to an Icelandic lady whom we'd met, and one or two of the other officers. We went down to see what this place was like. And it was in the heart of the Casbah, which was an area which we weren't recommended to go into anyway. And there was a vivid red door with a little black porthole in the middle of it, which was shut. So we rang the bell, and eventually the little porthole opened up, and we were greeted and swept in and invited to buy wine and so on. It turned out that although the attractions were upstairs in heaps and all the rooms and people going up and down, and there were hundreds of army people there as well as a few officers, it wasn't actually my scene. Although I did see for the first time in my life what we called an exhibition. The exhibition involved about half a dozen girls who undressed and did all the things that girls do when they're undressed. And they tried to excite some of the onlookers to join in. There was an Australian army officer there who drank too much. And whatever they did to him, quite clearly it was not up to him. He could no longer take much interest. And some of the people there were cheering him on like a football crowd, and some of them were holding him back like maiden aunts. And the whole thing was quite extraordinary. eventually I went back to the ship considerably wiser, because you must remember I was about 21 at the time, but actually entirely safe and not having to draw my revolver, which I felt was just as well. But on another occasion, I was the duty officer in Algiers when the rest of the warden went ashore. And the first tenant came back, really, one might say, very drunk. He was perfectly able to walk, but he decided that at 11 o'clock at night that what he really had to do was to practice his revolver shooting. So as he was entitled to open the locks on the cupboard with the revolvers in, he did that and gave himself some ammunition. Opened the porthole on the far side of the wardroom and tried to shoot from one side of the wardroom out of the porthole. Well, he couldn't have hit a barn door at 20 paces, and so bullets were tending to ricochet around the wardroom. And as the officer of the day, I felt I should perhaps do something about this. So with the help of the commercial traveller, what we did was... We agreed what we would do, because by then the first tenant had also approved that the leading steward should be drinking our stuff too. So the leading steward was delivering drinks on his knees. And I arranged that the commercial traveller would put the wardroom tablecloth over the head of the first attendant at the moment when the gun had been fired, so there wasn't another one up the spout, one hoped. And at the same time, I would hit him on the head with a golf club. And so that's what we did. And he was duly carried off to his cabin, obviously still alive and so on. And we thankfully sent the leading steward to bed and wound up the wardroom, so everything was locked up and the guns were put away and so on. Unfortunately, in the middle of the night, the first turn woke up about 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, went to the captain, still obviously tight as a tick, and told the captain there had been a mutiny on board which I'd led, which took a bit of explaining the next day, but the whole thing was hushed up. But clearly there were problems ashore, and the Red Infuriator was not restricted in its effects to the sailors. So, and I'll tell the story about a particular sailor, perhaps.